Coming up on Philosophy Talk,
the value of care, feminism and ethics,
the importance of caring for ourselves and others.
My baby don't care for shows. My baby don't care for clothes. My baby just cares for me.
Caring for others is a moral virtue.
Yeah, but can a whole moral theory be based on care?
Well, if we don't care, why would we treat each other ethically?
But shouldn't we treat even those we don't care about fairly?
People may care about people who care about themselves, but I just don't really care about those people.
Our guest is Joan Tronto from the University of Minnesota.
Author of Who Cares? How to Reshape a Democratic Politics.
Value of care.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Is it all right to care about some people more than others?
Or does morality require that we care about everyone equally?
Are we also required to care about perfect strangers?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Deborah Satz, and we're here at the studios of KALW in San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner down on the Stanford campus, where Deborah and I teach philosophy.
Today, we're going to be probing the ethics of caring.
Now, you know, Deborah, caring and being cared for are really important things for human beings. I mean, imagine a person who cared about nothing but him or herself. That kind of person would just be a monster. Or on the other side, imagine a person that nobody else cared about at all. Well, that person would be lonely and invisible.
But caring also has risks. Caring about one person too much might cause you to care about other people too little. Some people care about the wrong things altogether. Figuring out who and what to care about and to what degree, that can be a tricky thing.
I grant you it can sometimes be tricky, but there's some pretty clear cases, Deborah. I mean, I clearly owe my own children more care than I owe to complete strangers, for example. And, you know, just think about that. I would never even think of abandoning my station as their caregiver, you know, and to run off, even to do something noble like saving starving children in some distant land. I owe too much to my children for that.
Yeah, but, you know, Ken, it's wrong to let excessive concern for your own children make you totally blind to the needs of children around the world.
Well, I'm not blind to their needs. I'm not indifferent to their well-being. I mean, I have no desire whatsoever to see them starved or trafficked or neglected or anything like that.
But your indifference is not the point. Justice is the point. And justice sometimes requires us to be impartial.
Impartial toward my own children? No, come on. You're getting at some difference between impartiality and indifference. What is that?
Well, indifference implies that other people's needs don't matter at all. Impartiality requires that you treat everyone's and their needs equally.
Well, that sounds good in the abstract. I know some moral philosophers think that way. But frankly, Deborah, how's that supposed to work in practice? I mean, I can't take care of all the children around the world. I can do a lot for my own children. And not only is that not wrong, there's something right about my being more partial to my own children.
But, you know, you're underestimating what you can do for others. For example, instead of buying your own children the extra toys that they can't live without, you could donate that money to some charity that'll help those starving children you just claim to care about.
Well, I do care about them, but I think you're missing my point. You're not really addressing my point.
And what's your point, Ken?
Well, Deborah, we need to distinguish the concept of caring about someone from the concept of taking care of them. I care about lots of people that I'm in no position whatsoever to really take care of. Now, sure, in the abstract, moral, philosophical sense, maybe impartiality does require me to care about all children equally, but it surely can't follow from that my personal energies, my caring energies, should be equally devoted to taking care of all of them on a day-to-day basis, you know, impartially. That can't be.
Yeah, I grant that. You couldn't possibly do that, even if you wanted to.
Which then raises an important question. Even if I agree that I should impartially care about all people, how do I ensure that people in need are adequately cared for? And on whose shoulders should the burden of caring fall?
Well, I know where the burden does fall, for the most part. It's on the shoulders of women, whether it's in the family or in the market economy. And that's one reason feminists have been so concerned about the ethics of care.
Sounds like you think that it's a form of injustice for women to be doing the caring work. But, you know, I got to say, caring work is noble stuff, Deborah. It's spiritually and emotionally rewarding. We shouldn't be castigating these overburdened women. We should be praising the overburdened women who so often do the care work in society.
Praise them all you want, but we've got to pay them more. And look, in the context of the family, care work is basically uncompensated labor, and it's unequally shared between men and women. And even in the market economy, care work is radically undercompensated. Paid care workers are marginalized, stigmatized, and they're exploited. And they're mostly women of color.
You know, that's a powerful case you've made against the way we treat care work. I agree about that. And that raises an important question, given that you and I both agree that caring for and being cared for are really fundamental to human flourishing. Why do we do that?
So I think it's a big question about what we can do to elevate the status of care work in a society like ours that seems to care so little about those who do most of the caring.
That's a really hard question. And to help us answer that question, Deborah, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to talk to people laboring on the front lines of giving care. She files this report.
We should start with a few quick facts. Back when the New Deal was passed in the 1930s, domestic workers were specifically excluded from Social Security and worker protection laws. It wasn't seen as a real job. The first law to guarantee domestic workers the same basic protections as everyone else, like overtime pay, paid leave, and legal protection from harassment, wasn't on the books until 2010.
We have suffered in silence, and we are saying enough is enough! No more!
Before the workforce began to organize, it was perfectly legal in some states to exempt childcare and elder care workers and housekeepers from minimum wage laws. For a long time, this country has naturalized care work as something we're just entitled to get from the mostly women who do it, with little in return.
The cultural association of this work with work that women have historically done is a huge part of the reason why we've really struggled to recognize this workforce as a real professional workforce.
Ai-Jen Poo is a labor leader. She first found huge respect for care workers after witnessing the difference they made in her family. When her grandfather started to require more aid than her family could give, they had to place him in a nursing home against his wishes. She remembers visiting and seeing people comatose and in extreme pain.
My grandfather was just incredibly afraid, and I just wanted nothing more than to get him out of there, and he passed away after 3 months.
Her grandmother, on the other hand, is 93 and still able to live on her own. She goes to church twice a week, plays mahjong with friends, and has a good quality of life.
And she's able to do that because she has the support of two really wonderful home care workers. So the difference between the two is a huge source of inspiration for me.
Part of the reason it's taken so long to organize care workers to push for the protections that they're finally winning is there's no one workplace to reach them at.
The job is really specific in that it's hidden behind closed doors. You could go into any neighborhood and not know which homes are also workplaces. It's almost defined by invisibility.
But there are also less practical challenges. Care workers are up against the way the workforce is feminized and also marginalized for being disproportionately immigrants and people of color.
There is a way that we have internalized, all of us have internalized a story about care work being less valuable.
But Ai-Jen Poo says once she started talking to these workers,
there's also a way in which this workforce knows in their bones how important what they do is to the people that they support, the families that they support, and to the economy.
one of the reasons iGEMPOO cares so much about improving these jobs is they're the fastest growing jobs in our economy. We have an elder population boom. Life expectancy is growing longer. Millennials are starting to have children. All these people need care.
We used to rely on kind of a default solution of women staying home and taking care of family members. That hasn't been a viable path for the majority of households for several decades now.
Because one income isn't enough to support a family anymore.
At a time when we need more care than ever before, we have less of it.
That means our country needs a comprehensive plan for how we're going to provide care to everyone that needs but can't afford it. Paid family leave, universal child care, universal elder care. iGEMPOO says we're missing policy solutions.
I think we think about caregiving as a personal, private concern, a personal family matter as opposed to a public policy matter or a political priority for the country.
It's really an archaic idea. An idea about commerce and civic life and the state excluding the home and family and women and care. But now more than ever, home care workers don't work in their own home. These are jobs, and this country can't afford not to care. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Beale.
Thanks, Liza, for that fascinating and somewhat depressing tour of the front lines of care work in the United States. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Deborah Satz. And today we're thinking about the ethics of care.
We're joined now by Joan Tronto. She's professor of political science at the University of Minnesota and the author of many important books and articles, most recently, Who Cares? How to Reshape a Democratic Politics. Joan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
So, Joan, how did you yourself first get interested? And you spent an entire academic career thinking about questions about care and democracy. Were you once one of those underpaid, marginalized, invisible care workers that we've been talking about?
I was a teacher's aide, but that's not the most important way I got involved. The most important way I got involved was by being a feminist. And in the 90s, the 80s, thinking about the question, if women become like men, what gets left behind? Because that was kind of the main push of feminism at that time, to say men and women are completely equal and equally the same. But that made me ask what gets left out. And then on a more personal level, in 1991, I was very, very gravely ill. And I'm alive because of the care I received. Care isn't only about what we do for others. It's also about what others do for us. And we have to remember that every day of our lives, we're being cared for.
That's a great answer, Joan. So I want to now go back to the conversation that Ken and I were having. Lots of philosophers dating back at least to Kant think of ethics in terms of impartial duties to others. And those duties hold whether you care about other people or not. You seem to reject that approach. So could you tell us briefly why?
Yeah, I do on one level reject that. Of course, I think justice is important and the key standard by which we would even evaluate all of our care practices. But in order to arrive at justice, I think it's wrong. You philosopher guys do this all the time, to jump from it's either one or the other. And, you know, it's if you're not entirely 100% impartial, then you're completely without guidance. That's not true. In our actual lives, as Ken was saying, it's true we care more for our children than for other children. But, Deborah, as you pointed out, that doesn't mean you can care for your own children in a way that's excessive and makes it unjust the way other children are treated. But you don't have to think about every other child in the world. What we think about are our relationships.
But how do we balance, right? So if these are not the same, how do we balance the caring in individual relationships and caring for everybody, and how do we make sure that our individual vision, you know, and focus on specific people doesn't obscure the obligations we have to strangers?
So this becomes, the balance point becomes the political one. That is, we think about the fact that if you're caring for your children as well as you can, other people want to care for their children as well as they can. Do they have the resources to do that?
Yeah.
Think about those
I think philosophers are torn on this because it's a really hard thing, but I think you and Deborah are getting onto something. The balance question. When I undertake an obligation to care for my children in particular, I'm not thumbing my nose at the rest of the world. If it were a matter of thumbing my nose at the rest of the world, then it would be bad. So the impartiality part is you can't thumb your nose at the rest of the world in caring for your children. Right? I mean, so these things should be reconcilable. But you know what? I'm going to let you take that up after this break because I'm getting a sign. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about the ethics of care with Joan Tronto from the University of Minnesota.
In our next segment, we'll be taking a closer look at the nature of caring. Why is it so often women who take on the work of caring for others? Is it a matter of nature or nurture? And are there better and worse ways to do the work of caring?
Gender and caring, nature or nurture, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Don't we all deserve to be handled with care and the same amount of care? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and today we're talking about the ethics of care. Our guest is Joan Tronto from the University of Minnesota. She's the author of Who Cares? How to Reshape a Democratic Politics.
So, Joan, I want to ask you, I don't know if you have a quick and easy answer for this. I know people are divided, evolutionary biologists and psychologists on one side, other folks on another side. Why is it that women do most of the caring in almost all societies around the world? Is it a matter of nature or is it a matter of nurture? What do you think?
On some level, it begins with a biological difference that women give birth, right? So, but then sociologists would argue that advantage, the comparative advantage men have of not having to be around children, letting them go do other things, has been translated into other forms of advantage. Myself, I think everybody can learn to care and to care well. Caring is a practice, which means that we get better at it as we work at it and think reflexively about what the practice involves.
I want to go back to you. What you said got you first interested. You're being a feminist. I'm wondering about what follows if men and women, right, regard them as the same. It sounds like you're a kind of difference, what's called a difference feminist, that you believe there are kind of not culturally originated, there are lots of cultural differences, culturally inculcated differences, but it sounds like the part of you believe there are some non-trivial differences that come from biology or our different role in the evolutionary game of production and reproduction and all that. Is that right? I'm just hearing that in your voice, and I'm wondering if that's the right read.
No, it's not right.
Okay. So why did you make that thing?
It's really sad to me that feminists are often put in the category of ethics of care is put in this category of difference feminism, because it's not. It's basically a political claim about the equality. Well, in a democratic society, people have to care equally. That's a bottom line.
Okay.
People have to receive equal care. People have to have resources for caring for those around them that are equal. And under those conditions, everybody turns out to be the person they can be. What's unjust is, as Deborah's question implied and as the roving reporter's comments made clear, is when some people get put in caring roles, only caring roles, and others kind of give up their responsibility to do care work to those others.
What if some people just don't want to care? Supposing I don't want to care and I'm willing to pay somebody else to do the care work for me. Do you have an objection to that? Should everybody be forced to do caring work, whether they want to or not?
That's a hard question. Should everybody be forced to do national service? Actually, I think yes.
Uh-huh.
But on the question of care, we could talk about that another day.
Yeah.
On the question of care, I think if everybody were kind of inculcated into practices of care and everybody knew how to care, then we might have a norm of social expectation that everybody do care. Then if there's some particular reason why someone doesn't want to do care work, fine, they can excuse themselves somehow.
Well, I want to back up. I'm fascinated by this exchange right here. And one of the things that occurs to me, I tend to think of these things as really complicated, interactive things, because capitalism comes along at some point in human history, and everything, almost everything, gets commodified. So, you know, in the family, care work is, it's partly just the changing diapers and all that, but it's motivated by love and concern. It's really the work of caring in this other sense. In the capitalist economy, you know, I can hire somebody to do something for me. They don't have to care a whit about me, right? They're just a laborer who's, you know, they don't have to care about my kid to change my kid's diaper. I pay them. You know, when somebody sells me their kidney, I don't regard that as an act of altruism. When somebody donates their kidney, and we have very different attitudes toward those things. So I'm wondering about this. Doesn't it get complicated when we think of care work as a commodity, an economic commodity? Because doesn't it get divorced from caring in another sense? Or can it get divorced from caring in another sense?
So this is why I would say that the key, and this is, it's taken feminist philosophers, you know, a generation to figure this out. The most important thing about care is that it's about relationship. That means that it's not just delivering the commodity.
Right.
It's also what's happening on the human level between those people. Now, that happens at every level, right? There are always relationships. And this is also partly the answer to the impartiality question, because we do have relationships with others, even if they're far-flung, right?
So,
and the question is, to whom do we owe caring?
So you know, I'm on board with the idea that we ought to treat, you know, people who engage in this kind of work and in these kinds of relationships, we ought to treat them decently. We ought to, you know, reward them. We ought to recognize the importance, not just, as Ken was saying, by praising, but by paying.
I was being told.
But I'm you know, I'm just wondering, you know, some people don't want to have children. They don't want to engage in caring relationships. Is your view this is a burden that absolutely must be distributed equally between people? You said national service. You know, as you know, we currently allow people to, like, opt out of that. We don't have national service. We don't have a draft. You know, is your view there's something good, like it's a component of a good life and people ought to be, you know, required to contribute? Or is it, you know, if people want to devote themselves to other things, that's for the people themselves to make the choices, in given a background where everybody has the equal ability to make the choices without unequal constraints.
So wait a minute, I'm going to add on to your question, Deborah. I don't want to pile on, but I'm going to add on really briefly.
But you do want to pile on.
Well, yeah, just because I want to know, if your national service idea applies to caring as nurturing or caring as economic commodity. Am I required to change a certain number of diapers, or am I required to, like, love a certain number of people? You know what I mean? But still, Deborah's question, but I just want to add that dimension.
Yeah, it's neither of those. So, but we can, let's start with Deborah's question about whether or not some people can make the choice not to care. And the answer is no. At the very least, everyone has to care for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what I would do in a democratic society is actually think about us making a list of all the care responsibilities we have, and then ask the question, who gets to take on these care responsibilities, and who gets to give everybody a voice, and then ask who wants to refuse some of these care responsibilities. And frankly, there may well be reasons why people don't want to take care. If parents and children had a very difficult relationship, to say that the children should have to take care of the parents is not a, you know, is not a just solution.
Yeah.
But in order for someone to come to that decision, they don't just get to make a choice on their own. Or if they happen to be people with a lot of money, get out of it because they have a lot of money.
So,
and therefore don't have to justify their decisions to others.
So I'm interested, you know, you can think about this question on the individual level, like for one person making a decision about what to do. And you can think about it from the point of view of public policy. And those seem to me to be very different from the public policy point of view. You know, I think there are lots of reasons to think it is, you know, manifestly unjust. that the system of incentives and social structures that we have disproportionately lead to women doing the majority of care work. And that then also ramifies other disadvantages they have in society because it disables them at work. It makes them more dependent on high wage earners and all of that. That's a public policy issue. And so I'm all for, you know, creating a set of social structures that would, equalize the incentives or the burdens or the rewards between men and women. But I'm still, you know, that's very different than saying that now once you've done that, people should themselves make the choices to each engage in care work.
We kind of tell people all the time, not directly but indirectly, what their choices should be. The fact that our society is a capitalist one, and if you don't have enough money, you can't do anything, means that people get socialized into what will be acceptable work habits in school.
Yeah.
Okay, so one could instead train people not only to work, not only to be productive, but also to take care of themselves and of others
and of
the environment.
I totally agree with you. That's culture. That's culture formation. I don't think... I don't know if I agree or disagree with you, Deborah. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. There's a sharp issue here. But I think our culture and our politics... Let's go back to the ancient Greeks' idea of citizenship and citizens as friends, right? Citizens as friends, so they're a community, and they see to each other's good and all that. That's a lovely idea. I love that idea. We've lost that, right? And we've got this concept. We've got something like the citizenship, the public, as something like Hobbesian competition under these rules. And that's terrible. That's a terrible way to be. Capitalism cements that notion of a Hobbesian competition. We need to reclaim our culture. We need to reclaim our culture, and we need to think of building a community. Because we agreed at the beginning, caring and being cared for, those are really important to human flourishing. We need to build a culture that emphasizes that, that celebrates that, that starts from that presupposition, it seems to me. So I think I'm on your side, Joan. I'm not sure.
I would agree that this is closer to the ancient idea of citizenship as friendship. But remember, the ancient Plato and Aristotle built their models on an assumption that somebody else was doing all the care work.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's why women, slaves, metics were excluded from citizenship. The real challenge that we face as democratic citizens, really the biggest challenge, is the fact that we've now included everyone into the political order. Great. That means nobody's left to do the care work. But the care work is absolutely vital for our existence as humans, and it teaches us important things about what it means to be human. So we have to find some way of balancing those values of individual achievement, competition, with values of caring for others, being generous, thinking, reflecting on what it means to be caring for others.
Yeah, so in your work, you actually make, I think, important distinctions between the idea of caring for people, caring with people. So care work seems to me not identical to caring for people. And so I agree, a democratic culture really requires that people in some ways care for other people. They have to see themselves as part of a common community. But to actually do care work, we could distribute care work equally among everybody. We could have a division of labor where some people do care work and some people don't. And I'm still not quite clear where you fall on this. If you think everybody, like national service, everybody should do care work, or whether it's okay for some people to opt out of doing care work as long as the background circumstances are fair and people, you know, women aren't disproportionately facing, you know, worse set of choices than men.
Now we can go back to, again, the early feminist work about the reproduction of mothering, where the argument made was if men are excluded from doing the kind of hands-on caring work for children from the moment of birth on, then they have a different relationship to their children than they would if they were doing that work. So Nancy Chodorow, for example, made the argument that if men did that work alongside women, we would be different kinds of people than we are now with very rigid gender differences.
That all seems true. But Jeff, I want to ask you a question. I'm not sure if I get something you're saying. I don't mean to be putting thoughts in your mouth, okay? So tell me if I'm getting it wrong. Look, I think there's a starting problem of the liberal democratic order. There's a starting problematic. We don't intrinsically care about each other, right? It's not like we start out, we're free, autonomous individuals, unconstrained by the other, and we come together because of some reason, like we gotta have a scheme of cooperation in order to thrive, but it's not driven by our intrinsic concern for one another. I think that once you start with that.
But I don't think, I mean, and I think Joan agrees with this, I don't think that's where we start. We're a cooperative species,
we
care. So that's why I wanted to separate caring and care work, which seem to me they're, you know, connected, but they're distinct. And you could imagine distributing care work. I mean, again, Joan, I thought it was helpful. You raised the analogy of national service. So we currently distribute national service in a more market-like way, right? We have a volunteer army. You enlist.
Yeah,
it's not required that everybody serve. Well, that maybe you're and Joan are on the same side. Maybe I'm on that side too, but that's what I'm trying to probe.
Yeah. Right.
You could have the view, you know, that everybody ought to do this. Or you could have the view, we should distribute it in the most efficient way possible. What's important is that people care about one another, but actually who does the care work, what's important is, again, background circumstances are fair, and we reward people, you know, appropriately for doing this kind of labor.
What do you think, Joe?
So let me answer that question directly. I think care work teaches us something important about the nature of care and about the nature of ourselves. And therefore, I do think everybody should be engaged in care work. Not all the same. Not everybody has to do the same amount of time, you know, in the same nursery, and then everybody marches out and rakes the lawn. Not what I mean.
Do you think an intrinsic connection? Because I can, again, I just think of the capitalist commodification of everything and that it divorces. I mean, capitalism can divorce the incentives for care work from the incentives for caring. You can do care work for people you care not a whit about. So, and if in those circumstances, does doing care work actually lead to caring or teach you something about caring?
So it partly depends on whether you think the outcome of care work is creating relationships among people, thinking about what it means to be human, or whether you think that the end result is that glass of wine got poured.
Right.
If it's the latter, then you can treat it like a service and you can treat it like a commodity. But it's the former, which is what I'm trying to get us to think more about, then no.
Okay. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about feminism and care ethics. Our guest is Joan Tronto from the University of Minnesota.
In our final segment, we'll think more about the distribution of care work in society. In particular, how can we achieve greater gender justice?
Achieving a just distribution of care when Philosophy Talk continues. What should we do when some people in our society feel no one cares about them? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Deborah Satz, and our guest today is Joan Tronto from the University of Minnesota, and we're having a wonderful conversation about care, care work, and the value of care.
So, Joan, we're going to do something that we do on Philosophy Talk from time to time with some of our guests. You're one of the privileged that we do this to. We're going to make you czar for a day of both the private and public sphere. We're going to give you plenary powers, so anything you say goes, right? And your task, you have a day to perform this, is to implement a more just distribution of caring and care work and all that. What's the first thing you would change, either in the family or in the paid economy, whichever you want?
All this power. The first thing I would do is pass a rule that says nobody can work more than 20 hours a week, and everybody has to care for some amount of time every week.
Wow.
So the first part of that, the 20 hours a week, Nancy Fulbright and I have been saying this for 20 years. The last piece, actually Jennifer Nadelsky and Tom Mallison at the University of Toronto are finishing up a book called Part-Time for All, a Care Manifesto. And it's so I've just stolen their idea, really.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that the first thing we have to do is create time. Because the most difficult thing about care is that it requires time. And the more time you have, the better you care. And everybody knows that when you say it, right? Caring for your kids, you care better. If you're a healthcare worker and you have more time with your patients, you care better. If you're a teacher, you have more time with your students, you care better. We all know that time is the critical piece here. And I'm glad you keep calling this a capitalist economy, because then it's easy to say time is the most important commodity that care has lost its capacity to control.
So I'm going to take a call before we go back to this question, this point. So Elon, sure. From Oakland, you're on the air.
Hi. I love the conversation. Thank you for taking my call. So in thinking about this conversation about how we think care should work in our society, it seems to me that we also need to address why is it the way it is now. And kind of my question is, it's just looking at the kind of the across-the-board type of works that involve caring, a lot of them are seem to be low-status jobs. And beyond the gender distribution, my question is, it why in our society we think it's something that it's someone who with lower society, like status in the society, should do.
Good question. You got a thought, Joe? Thanks for the call, Elon.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and you're quite right. It's not just women; it's women, especially also people of color, people who are distinguished, working class people. All get stuck with doing what Mignon Duffy called non-nurturant care. So there's care that we all think about. When we think about caring, we think about, yes, helping our baby learn to walk or something like that. But the truth of the matter is much of care work is what Dorothy Roberts called dirty work. And because it's associated with dirty work, that makes it lower status. Or I should put it differently. Because it's dirty work, people of lower status get stuck doing it. Because that's the way the society can organize itself.
Yeah. But there's two things. I mean, there's the dirty work, the non-nurturant care. That's low status. But there's also, like, the caring and helping professions, many of which are very high status. Doctors, right? Therapists. Priests aren't paid a lot of money, right? But they're supposed to be, they're part, they care for your soul. And we think of those as really noble things.
Right. Not especially nurturant care, like therapists.
Right.
Counselors, those kinds of folks. And once again, they tend to be white, middle-class people, not lower-class people, as Elon was asking about. Doctors are a particularly interesting group because doctors deliberately change their status from being just caregivers to being mainly scientists. And if you look at the way doctors' pay scales are organized, the more you're a research scientist, a doctor doing cutting-edge research, you get better compensated than if you were a pediatrician or an internist or a family doctor.
Or even within not the researchers, but just the like surgeons, people who do procedures, as opposed to people who talked to you.
Right.
The people who do procedures are radically more highly compensated.
Right.
But you had
so
a point you wanted to make.
Just on this, it does seem to me that you can't fully separate the gendered component from the low pay, because it's precisely historically because this was women's work that it was so lowly, you know, so it got such low rewards. And I remember reading something, I can't remember now, who wrote about this, you know, that zookeepers get paid much more than childcare workers.
Really?
You know, so, and zookeepers tended to be men.
Talk about dirty work.
Right.
But it's also working class men who get, who do a lot of the dirty work.
Absolutely.
Think of people who collect garbage or who do work in laundries, who work in really dirty, unpleasant work.
We got a caller on the line, Lisa from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Yeah, this is a very good program. I've always enjoyed it. I think that I was in Cuba, and I came back about a month ago. And one of the things that struck me is the change of culture. And I've been to other countries in Latin America, so it's not as if I had not known this. But it's very incredible how children are treated, that they're given deference. Elderly people are given deference. The fact that that they have health care, free education all the way to PhD, and also the fact that even they have this Latin American School of Medicine where they even accept and have trained excellent doctors from the United States, from lower-income communities of the United States, and the only requirement is for them to go back to their communities, low-income communities, communities of color, and practice medicine, general medicine, primary care medicine, or whatever specialty that they would like. But it basically shows a major difference in culture that is supported by a different social system.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation, Lisa. What do you think about that, Joan? You got a response or a reaction? Thanks a lot, Lisa.
It's a difference in how you're valuing caring in the society. It's possible, and it's possible to create societies where care for elderly, disabled people, or people with disabilities, I should say, children, more marginal people are treated better. It's certainly possible to do that.
So I wanted to go back to the 20 hours a week,
which we dropped,
which I thought was a great...
Yeah.
You're about to take a new job that's going to be 200 hours a week.
Exactly. I love the idea of 20-hour work week. So I'm wondering how you think about people who don't work at all, particularly now I'm thinking about women in the home. This is less of an issue now than it was... 50 years ago, since we have more and more people actually engaging in market economy work, but there's still disproportionately, it's women who don't work. When you're thinking about the 20-hour cap, are you thinking it's also important that everybody do some work outside the home? Is that a
Jenny
piece of
Nadelsky
this?
Jenny Nadelsky thinks that, yeah. That would be a piece of it, that you'd ask everyone to do some kind of paid work. But there might be other ways to think about how to organize this and compensate this.
So I want to ask you to step back for a second. Talked about the historical contingency of this, but I want to figure out, and Lisa, I think it was Lisa, our caller, talked about the difference between Cuba and here. And if you go around like Scandinavia, there's all kinds of different ways people organize this stuff. There are problems over the world. But what is it about America? What is it about the American psyche? Deborah said we start out as cooperative people, right? But you look at American society, and that's hard to case to make. I mean, maybe in an ideal, but why are we the way we are? Is there something deep within the psyche of this country that says, oh, caring for your elderly parents, that's a private matter. Caring for your children, that's a private matter. If you can afford it, you if not, no. Why are we like this? It strikes me as a kind of disease, to tell you the truth. But why are we? What's the source of this disease?
Wow, that's a hard question. What is the source of it? Well, part of it is the winner versus loser mentality in this country, where if you're not a winner, you're a loser, and therefore everybody has to be a winner. And what you want to do then is train your children to think of themselves as winners, not as losers, as opposed to thinking of people having some, common interests, common goals, common life. That's one piece of it. It's about the fact that we do live in a capitalist economy, which means that if you don't have money, you don't have lots of other things.
Yeah.
You don't have good health care. You don't have good child care. You probably have a job where you can't take off to go to your school, your kid's school when there's a recital.
So there are other capitalist economies that don't raise the stakes of of being a winner to the extent that the U.S. does. Because here, if you lose out, you don't just lose out on a good job. You lose out on everything. You lose out on health care. You lose out on child care. You lose out on school education. Whereas in other societies, they've kind of roped off an area where, the stakes aren't that high because you're guaranteed certain basic goods that are seen as part of citizenship. And we don't seem to have gotten on board with that idea. We're still in the mode of citizenship as just a narrow political category about who can vote.
We are. I mean, I think that's really right. I think that goes deep, deep within the American psyche. I wish, if I had one wish, I wish I could excise that tendency, but I don't know how.
A 20-hour work week.
Can you help us, Joan? I got to say to you about it quickly, but you got some last wise thoughts. You seem to me like a very wise person. So share your last wise thoughts with us.
Well, that's kind of you to say. There's so many pieces of this that we are just scratching the surface of. So another piece of this, and back in the roving reporter's comments about the New Deal and domestic work was not a real job. Of course, the reason for that was race.
Yeah.
Southerners wouldn't go along unless that exclusion was
absolutely
in there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so when you go back in history, what you need to do is look at who took on which responsibilities and who rejected which responsibilities. Because then you come to the point where we are today, where the only form of responsibility that has any political uptake is personal responsibility.
Yeah.
That's not right. We all have relationships with others. They're not all the same, and so our relationship creates different levels of responsibility. But the levels of responsibilities for caring for others, for caring for ourselves, frankly, for caring for our world, are really important for us to figure out.
On that note, Joan, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. This has been a care-filled, careful conversation, and I really enjoyed it, so thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Joan Tronto. She's a professor of political science at the University of Minnesota, author most recently of Who Cares? How to Reshape a Democratic Politics. So you got a last closing brief thought for us?
I think Joan has, you know, written an important book and made an important point that the shape of our democracy is bound up with issues about the distribution of care, how we think of care, how we treat care, and how we treat care workers.
I think that's right. I think that's a profound point. And I actually think we're in something of a crisis because of the way we treat care workers and the distribution of the emotional citizen labor of caring about each other. But you know what, folks? This conversation, this careful, care-filled conversation, continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community, and please do, by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on our blog. And now, here's someone who clearly cares too much and too fast. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I just got unfriended on Facebook, which made me think about the caring economy, of which Facebook is an epitome. America seems to be on two tiers these days. The close the borders, take away food stamps, clamp down on health care, pursed lips, squinty, what's in it for me, America. And the inclusive, Me Too, Black Lives Matter, transgender bathrooms for everybody, America. I am more in the second camp than the first, but I must admit, progressives really get on my nerves, which led to the Facebook situation. This woman I know, well, a Facebook friend, do I really know her? No. She posted a thing that began, I am typing this through my tears, which immediately made me go, why didn't you wait until you're through crying before typing? Anyway, she was bent out of shape because her dad supposedly had told her he wasn't coming to visit her because she had hurt his feelings last time he came. She said she would never treat her son like this, and then shared some of the email he had sent her about his grievance with her, which has nothing to do with advice he'd given her about the biotech industry in San Diego or something, which she had not taken or ignored. I couldn't follow it. I kept thinking, why are you sharing this with us? If your beef was with your dad, tell him. Anyway, I wrote a response on her page basically saying, good God, you're sobbing at your keyboard. What are you, 12? Your profile picture looks 40-something to me. I thought better of it and deleted the post. It was up for all of 10 seconds, I would say, which was long enough for her to read it and unfriend me. Not only unfriend me, but PM me with a personal message chiding me in a schoolteacherish way for being sarcastic and unhelpful. She began it with, I am releasing you back into the wilds of Facebook like I was a puppy she'd adopted who wouldn't stop peeing on the couch. Now, the thing is, she's the one who first asked to friend me after she read some snarky thing I'd posted that amused her. So snark is fine until it snarks you, I guess. Facebook is a weird, weird place. It's there for you to post what are basically diary entries that you allow people to read. So there's a kind of interaction that's not really an interaction at all. That is, you're supposed to read and react to posts, but only positively and sympathetically. This often involves emojis and pictures of kittens. No mockery, no questioning, no argument. Just read it and weep, or read it and laugh. Read it and agree. Trump is bad. Hillary is bad. Read the room. Respond accordingly, and then go on to the next post until it's past your bedtime. Making this sort of thing, rather than ethics, the foundation of morality, can only lead to trouble. Not making somebody feel bad because it's wrong, in other words, seems more useful than not making somebody feel bad because they might unfriend you. Where does that lead? Well, it leads to Facebook, my friends. And to tell you the truth, I really don't care. I mean, it's only Facebook. Just walk away. What are you, 12? I gotta go.
Philosopher's Corner. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeyer, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners in our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed on the program don't necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or any of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Deborah Satz.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Well, Al, it's nice to see you care about something besides wondering whose back is hairier. Yours or your dog's.